about Father Stan Rother. Thank you.
I'm going to get this hooked up here so that we can get this recorded the right way. I visited the doctor today, and he stuck a big probe in my ear and then stuck some oil in it. So I sound to me like I'm talking from the bottom of a big well. I hope it doesn't sound like to you that way. Several times in my parish, I've been there just a couple of years, people will come up to me and say, you know, I talked to somebody in your family. They live somewhere here in Oklahoma City. And I said, man, you're going to have to do a lot better than that to narrow things down. I have a family that's pretty gargantuan on both sides of my family, my father's side and my mother's side. Father Stanley Rother was my second cousin on my mother's side. My mother was a Rother from Okarchi. Father Stanley, you know, headed off to the seminary, of course, when he got out of high school. He was born in 1935, headed off to the seminary 18 years after that. Not so unusual for a young guy from Okarchi who decided to go to the seminary, certainly not at his time. But, of course, I was born 20 years after that, so when he was in the seminary and his first years of ordination, of course, I was just a kid, and so I knew his parents, I knew some of his younger siblings who were around, but I didn't know him very well, not really, until he and I began to go to clergy days together when I was a seminarian. He'd been in Guatemala for many years, and I knew of him and was around him some when he would come home, but didn't know him all that well until much later on, which was kind of interesting since he was part of the family, but I didn't really know him just as one guy to another. I knew him as a seminarian and later as when I was ordained. Stanley's last trip home to Oklahoma before he was murdered was for my ordination, and so I always treasure that. I always think that, and during, ordination, we pray the litany of the saints. So at most people's ordinations, we pray to the saints. At my ordination, we prayed with a saint. And so, but you know, the fundamental question as we begin to consider, the notion of beatification is to ask, who cares? Or what is this all about? Why would we end up focusing on the life of someone distant and removed from us, even the few years that separate us from the life of somebody like Stanley Rother, or an example of someone whose life is located at a place so far away from us and an experience of life light years away from what we experience? It was a question that separated the church at the time of the Reformation, where people reacted against the church's focus on the life and the personality of those who had come before. You can still go to the Gothic cathedrals in France, especially on the outside, and see where rampaging mobs moved through there during the time of the Reformation and chopped the heads of the statues off, because it was the faces many times that detailed who the saint was. They would load all these heads up and dump them into the river because it was their statement that their faith in Christ transcended what example of saints were. It was a reaction to the church's focus on that. And so the question really remains in our day and time, what difference does this kind of example make? What would it be that we would gain by focusing on someone like Stanley, removed from us? And I think it really comes down to the kind of focus that we have. You know, Stanley is regarded, and his pathway to beatification has to do with his martyrdom. He died, as the statement from the Vatican office said, in odium fide, because of hatred of the faith. He wasn't killed just because he was stubborn and he was going to show those people in the army who occupied Santiago. He wasn't just not going to be pushed around. It wasn't because he was hard-headed, although he was. It wasn't just that. It was because he was living the faith as a witness to it, which is what the word, of course, martyr means. It is those who witness. And it's in fact the case that that all of us who want the invitation to follow Christ, we want the invitation to be fleshed out. And what we find in the lives of another person is how to flesh out what the invitation to follow Christ looks like. You know, in the letter of James, faith without works is like a body without breath. If you profess faith, it has to be in act or it's for nothing. And so unless the hands are connected somehow to the intellect, unless there's some sort of expression, then, well, we can talk about faith all day long, and it means no more than our wonder at the change of the leaves during the change of seasons. It doesn't mean anything. And the question becomes then, how to live this? Gil Bailey, a lecturer, he often points to the fact that St. Paul reminded people that if you want to know if your question is, what do I do next? Well, he said, imitate me in my commitment to Christ. Imitate me. I am an image of, or desire to be, an image of faithfulness to Christ. What is one of his final salutations, which is, I live not I, but Christ lives in me. If you see me, then you see Christ. And who is Christ? Christ is the image of the Father. And so if you are a generation removed from St. Paul and you turn to a person in the Corinthian community and you say, what does it mean to follow Christ? And he says, I'm imitating Paul, imitating Christ, who is the image of the Father. If we say, I want to imitate the witness of Stanley Rother, who his conscious witness was the pastor of the church in Okarche, Zenon Stieber from Belgium, from Alsace. And Zenon Stieber's immediate image of the life of the Father was his pastor. And it all goes down the line to the one who imitates Christ, who is the image of the Father. That's what it means to flesh out the life in Christ. That's why the witness of what life in Christ is so important for us, and why all of this comes to us as naturally as believers as any part of the faith. Collecting the witness of the martyrs in the church is as old as collecting the scriptures in the church. The list of those who were killed for the faith is a project as old as getting all of the scriptures together and making sure they're the right ones. This is natural to us. What does it mean to believe? And you know, we're just entering a time when that takes on a whole new phase in humanity. Several years ago, I was at the Jesuit retreat house in Wernersville, Pennsylvania, and they have a great big old chapel. It used to be the Jesuit formation house. The chapel's huge, and the stained glass windows on each side are just gigantic, like two stories tall. And I was sitting in there one day, I was looking around, and I thought, you know, it's kind of interesting, because in the figures, they have St. Peter and St. Paul, they have Joan of Arc, St. Ignatius, a couple of other saints. And the first thing I noticed when I looked is that the faces of all the saints are absolutely identical. Joan of Arc looks exactly like St. Paul. I guess it's cheaper to make one face and slap it on that each pane, you know, and then just build the rest of the saint around the face, which is kind of a temptation that we fall into. Every saint's witness looks the same if they're sufficiently removed. So Saint looks like Saint Thomas, looks like Saint Bonaventure, you know, looks like St. Vincent de Paul. Well, their lives were as different and their situations as contrasting as anyone could imagine. But because they just seem like saints to us, they all seem the same. But you know, we have a slightly different take on that these days, because now we live at a time when the people who are saintly, the witness that they offer us, is accompanied by photographs. It's just breathtaking to see Saint Giorgio, you know, who's this young young man from Italy. He looks like a frat boy, which he kind of was. And to see him in his mountain climbing garb looks like he owns the world in this photograph is really heartening. Or to see the picture that everyone's seen of a young Thérèse of Lisieux, you know, a girl. Again, with this, she looks in that photograph like she has self-possession. Or to see the photograph of a young Mother Teresa just before she goes into the convent in Ireland. You know, it's a, pretty soon, though, you know, we're going to be coming up on the time when if we still have the machines to play them, we'll have the VCR tapes of when a saint was born, you know. Oh, that's him there! What that does for us, of course, is it enlivens, it reinforces what sanctity is supposed to do. This example is an example that informs us. It builds the bridge between this sort of vaporous notion that faithfulness to Christ is this sense out there. And that vaporous notion condenses into the lives and the example and the living witness of people whose lives in Christ has made a difference. Which is why we pay attention to someone like Stan Rother, someone whose life touches our lives, someone who, at a minimum, grew up inside of the same kind of environment that forms and shapes that formed and shaped his life, that formed and shapes our lives. Which I think is why the witness of Stan is something that connects for us and something worthy to pay attention to. Now, there are a couple of parts about Stan's life that I think that is worthy to say. And, you know, who was it? I'll think of her name here in a minute. She used to say, "You can't call me a saint. You can't dismiss me that easily." And there is a temptation to do that. I was really proud to speak at the 25th anniversary of Stan's death at the parish in Okarchi. That was the parish where my mother and father were married. And, you know, I had probably about 7,000 cousins who were baptized there in that baptismal font. You know, for a town of 800 people, its influence in the state of Oklahoma is practically unbelievable. But, we were there what I was able to say, and I was really proud of this point, and that is, we shouldn't create a Stanley who didn't exist, which is the temptation that we have when we start to consider sanctity. But, you know, it's a sort of natural temptation because of this. In that very same town, my first cousin, Francis Crittenbrink, got married to his wife, Christy. Christy told me years later that she arrived, I think, as a ninth grader when Francis was an 11th grader. And she came in the middle of the year. She was a Baptist in the most Catholic town in Oklahoma. She was not a part of anybody's family in a place where everybody's connected to everybody else nine different ways. Francis' father, if he hadn't been my uncle, would have been my second cousin. So, she walked into the cafeteria on the very first day and said, Francis was the kind of guy who would give everybody a hard time. Francis was over giving somebody a hard time, and she said to herself, "I'm going to marry him." And they got married just about 15 minutes after she got out of high school. What the temptation is that when we look at the life of Stanley Rother, whenever it was, as a kid growing up in Okarchi, a picture of him on a tractor, you know, pulling a plow. Stanley going off to the seminary. Stanley getting kicked out of the seminary, asked to leave because his grades were not up to it. Stanley, you know, kind of wandering around during the first 5 years of his time in the priesthood. When he just arrives in Guatemala, et cetera. Pick a moment. Our temptation is to imagine that because that moment is part of this continuum that is his life, that like a seed, everything in the future is contained at that moment. And of course, it's true enough. It really is. It's true enough that in the child was the man, and inside of the decision to go to the seminary was the decision to be faithful to the call that had received to remain in Guatemala. It was all contained there. But, you know, it doesn't do justice to the experience to imagine that somehow there was a tint of sanctity that removed all of the confusion or the darkness in Stanley's life that we have in our lives about what tomorrow is going to look like. Stanley, when he got ready to go to Guatemala, didn't know what that would be like. When he became pastor eventually, didn't know what that would turn into. When he began to press back against the forces in Santiago that were pressing on him, he didn't know what that would look like. When it came time, just before he was killed, when the pressures were mounting and he openly talked to me about, he didn't say, if somehow they come for me, he would say to all of us, when they come for me, he didn't know what that would be like. He didn't know what a life of faithfulness would condense into his life. So it's important for us to remember that we can pick out a moment and we can say, there is the image of a saint. He's 9 years old. Or, you know, to see the picture of him. You know, he was always thin, like his dad. But there he is in his cassock, which just sort of emphasizes how slim he was. And to say, okay, now, there's the image of a saint. Or to see him, you know, some of the pictures that we have over here, as he was, you know, that famous picture of him standing on the front doors. It's not the front door of the church, I don't think. I think it's the front door of the little hall right next door. But anyway, he's standing there with the little the Guatemalan girls. It's extending... That's the image of a saint. Well, yes. As a matter of fact, yes. But the invitation to our sanctity is to remember at that moment he was extending his hand to this little girl. At that moment, he was trying to be a faithful pastor. At that moment, I mean, who knows what was going through his head. At that moment, you know, as that photograph is snapped, you know, he draws his hand back, looks at his watch, and says, "Oh my God, I gotta get out of here." You know? That's also the image of sanctity. That's what the martyrdom witnessing does for us, if we remember what this witness has to tell us. You know, that's something that's I think for me really important. This is another thing that's important. Did you ever read I'm trying to think of the exact citation. I can't think of it right now. Moses, when he's leading the people through the desert, he goes in to commune with God. He goes up on the mountain to commune with God. And when he comes down, his face is glowing. Glowing. So much so that the people insist he wear a veil. Because, I mean, they all have to do business, and doing business like this, you know, is really hard. You're shading your face. And so they insist he wear a veil, and so that when Moses is out doing the normal stuff, the glow on his face is so overwhelming. Now, imagine for a moment, what would the veil that Moses wore, what would it look like? You know what it looks like? I'll tell you, you can tell what it looks like. But when you go home today and you go into the bathroom right before you go to bed, flip on the lights and look in the mirror. That's what the veil looks like. Because everybody here has been baptized. And what we claim, what Jesus said, what St. Paul assured us about baptism, of course, is that our encounter with God is as real and as immediate and as intimate as Moses' encounter with God. If we want to know what the veil is, look at this. You think that's what people look like? That's the veil that covers the glory that they're bathed in. If we could take the mask, we would see what the glory of God is imprinted in us because of our humanity and because of the renewal of our humanity at baptism. Now, when we have someone, for example, like Father Rother, whose image of sanctity becomes a marker of what faithfulness and faithful witness is, we have a moment to see what the mask removed looks like. But the truth of the matter is that it's simply a moment to see what the mask removed is. A mask all of us wear. We become so comfortable imagining that this is really our face. Most of us forget that there is a face that glows underneath this mask. And that's what Stanley's example does for us. He is a witness to the truth of our lives, the truth of our humanity renewed, reborn in baptism. That's why we pay attention. All it would take, really, is for us to know the dignity of our baptism, for us, in fact, to glow with the same kind of piercing presence that Moses brought to the people, that the witness of the saints is what the glow of the saints in the heavenly choir. That's why it's important to pay attention in the life of why his life connects to our life and makes a difference to us and is so real for us. Stan is it's his glory that opens our eyes, I think it's always so powerful to know. It certainly is for me to know that he's from here. Somebody was telling me that. Some time ago, they were to make a little pilgrimage from where Stan was, the farm there in west of Okarchi, and come down the road to the cemetery where Stan's buried. You know, for me, my grandfather's farm was just 1 mile west of where Franz and Gertrude's farm is. All the Rothers kind of used to live in just in succession there, one farm right after the other, and out west of town. And of course, it's always you can tell who doesn't belong to Okarchi, because when they actually find the cemetery and find out how to get there, you know, it's one of those places you can see it, you just can't get there from where you are on the road. When you find out where it is and then you go to the cemetery, you can tell if you don't really belong in Okarchi. They just walk down the road. And if they have the instructions about where his grave is, they just go there. Of course, if you belong to Okarchi, you're out going, you know, since I'm related to all the people over here, you know, I have a few other graves to visit. Stanley's witness is the beginning of the realization that this is a witness of a faithful life. And faithfulness isn't limited to the ones who laid down their lives in blood. You know, Stanley's witness began first in service and then later was finalized in blood. But his witness wasn't less, than the witness of 10 dozen people who also lay in that cemetery. Their holiness is as real and as palpable and as productive as Stanley's holiness. If you knew them, you would know what the mask removed looks like. Stanley becomes a witness, yes, but also a representative of all of those that we're too tired or too lazy or too preoccupied to notice and to celebrate. You know, think about this. If you were to write a true and real history of the Catholic Church in Oklahoma, what would you do? Well, you'd do the only thing you could do. You would go to the files, you know, and you would read what's in the files. And you would read the letters, and you read the exchange of correspondence, and you get an idea of things. If you were really lucky, you could hit some of the parishes and maybe dig out some of the stuff that we have, under the stairwells that we have it stuffed there until we get ready to throw it away. Things like that. What we would be left with is the documentary history of the arch of the Catholic Church in Oklahoma, which of course everyone knows is about 0.1% of what actually really happened. Right? You could read all that stuff and write a dozen books about what you found and still miss everything. Why? Because the history of the Catholic Church in Oklahoma is the history of Mrs. Smith, whose witness and service and life affected all these people around her, who in turn, the witness of her faithfulness founded in them the faithfulness that spread out in a dozen different places. As I walked into the rectory today, I noticed there was a cursillo application form on the desk there in the front area. And I just mentioned to Father Brian that I'd done my first cursillo in many, many years in English. I'd been involved with the Spanish-speaking cursillo for a long time. But, you know, cursillo doesn't have a post office box. It doesn't have a telephone. It doesn't, in our diocese, doesn't have any stationery. It has the names of some people sort of connected to that, but there's no file anywhere in the archdiocese that says cursillo on it. Now, cursillo has been active in our diocese for going on 40 years. It's affected the lives of thousands and thousands and thousands of people, some of whose witnesses are extraordinary and the cursillo is the open door for their entrance into the fullness of life in the church. But 100 years from now, it's like it won't ever exist. There's nothing of remembrance there. It's not in a file someplace. The life of the faith is incomparably richer because of that experience of the thousands of people involved and the millions of hours given by those thousands of people during that time. That's what the life of sanctity really is. That's what holiness is. Thank God we have those whom we can point to, like Stanley, whose life rises to the extraordinary so that we have the invitation to remember and to celebrate the ordinary. When we do that, the invitation, of course, is to remember that there aren't any ordinary people. Everybody's example is extraordinary. It makes it sound like everybody's kid is above average. But think the ordinary that goes on in our lives, the ordinary stories that we have about people, the ordinary story that we had about Stanley, took until after he was murdered. I have a story about that. You know, Stanley's example was celebrated by lots of people. Faithful American who goes on mission. He stays behind. He serves as best he can. Conforms his life to the needs of the people there. You know, he brings his sort of native ability to there, but also his native stubbornness and his native contentiousness. And you know, if he was 1/10 like his dad, he would be like, you know, you couldn't change his mind in 10,000 years. Because his father never changed his mind about anything, ever. So you have this enormous witness. And the fact that he was willing to go back in the face of danger and willing to... It's just astounding. You know, I talked to the sister, one of the Carmelite missionary sisters of St. Teresa who were there, staffing the mission. And on the 25th of July of 1981, it's the Feast of St. James, the feast of the patronal feast of the town. It's a big deal. And that day they had a blood drive. And it didn't take long before, and the blood drive was very successful that day. It didn't take long in discussion to bring up that there were so many people in the village because of the repression that was going on, the army occupation of the village and the enormous violence of the time, to connect those who had shed their blood, those who gave blood that day so that others would live. And one of the sisters, and then to talk about, you know, the blood shed all around Guatemala and all around Santiago because of the violence. And one of the sister who was there told me this. She said, you know, we asked Father Rother, what would we do if they came for you? And Stanley said, they come for me. Go into the church, light the Easter candle, sing Alleluias. Extraordinary example. Someone who could see and understand, who knew. Now, even in the midst of that example, I remember getting the phone call on the day that he died. That, you know, it was, the phone call was this. It's all over. So, but you know, I had uncles who grew up with Stan. One uncle in particular who was a lot like his, like Stanley's dad. My uncle would have been Stanley's dad's first cousin. And in his opinion, you know, it was just, Stan was never that kind of bright shining star, you know. If you're from Okarchi, you know what I mean. Everyone knows who you are, and that's a big problem. In Okarchi, you know, if you're from the wrong place, in the mind of certain people, you could be an ignorant, poor fool. And you could get 9 PhDs, make $10 billion, and become president of the United States. And it would just go to show you're a rich presidential fool. You know, that's everybody knows who you are. Yeah. Nothing ever changes about their opinion, ever, 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 ever. In Spanish, they say, pueblo pequeño, infierno grande. A small town, big hell, right? Okay. My uncle thought Stanley was just a dullard. I mean, what a dope. He was in Oklahoma. He fled when he found out his name was on the death list in February. He came to Oklahoma, was here about 8 weeks, went back to Guatemala in time for Holy Week, stayed, came back for my ordination, went back down. July the 28th, murder. I mean, what a dope. I mean, God, just goes to show you. If he had been smarter, which was something he had lacked his whole life, not smart enough, he'd still be alive, he'd still be here. Now, that same uncle had a daughter who was living in Yukon, and her boyfriend came by to see her in the morning on his way to work, and he goes down to the parking lot to get in the pickup, and she lives in an apartment, and he goes down to the parking lot, and he left the keys up on her coffee table, goes into the apartment, and she's collapsed on the floor, calls an ambulance, rush her to the hospital. The parents come, my uncle, and the doctors walk out and start talking about organ transplant. I mean, harvesting her organs. She's had a burst aneurysm in her brain. You know, like no response. And, I mean, they're thinking that she has an hour or two to live. And you need to get ready, get permission, because there's no hope for this girl. And so they call back to their pastor. They live in Okarchi. Their pastor is one of Stan's oldest friends, Father Sam Levin, and he says, go to the church, pray for the intercession of Father Rother. 9 weeks later, she walks out of the hospital. Okay. Now, I mean, I know that story. There are other stories. I know that one. You know, my uncle doesn't think the same about Stan. He's the only guy in Okarchi ever changed his mind. Talk about miracles. Miracles happen. Having his daughter healed is nothing compared to the fact that he changed his mind. The power of witness makes extraordinary into the invitation that every life, every faithful moment, every act of desire in the image of faithfulness become a moment that glows, becomes a moment that stands apart, is framed by sanctity. When we remember the kind of witness that this witness was, everything becomes extraordinary. There are a couple of points in that. Some of the things that we can learn, some of the other things we can learn. I already mentioned one, and that is that Stan gave his life away in service before he gave his life away in blood. And that service began in several distinctive parts. One is in response to his vocation. Stan wanted to be a farmer like his dad and like lots and lots of the people his age in Okarchi at the time. And to leave that behind meant that he had to open his hands and let that dream flow through his fingers. Now, that's not new. It's something that had to happen before he could leave behind what he had been focusing on and go off and do something else. To leave behind. And, you know, Stanley was the kind of guy, like so many of the people in his generation that I knew growing up, was the kind of guy who it seemed like he could do anything if it had to do with mechanics or masonry or electrical work or those. I spent a month with his dad down in Guatemala. His dad put brake shoes on and replaced the bearings of every rolling thing having to do with the church there. Stanley could do all that stuff. To head off, to leave all that behind, that sense of mastery that kids, boys that who grew up on a farm in a German farm town, that they learn how to do. My cousin Francis was like that. He could do anything. He could do anything. It does one of two things. Either you stay close to everything that you know how to do. You stay, you know, you go past the sort of section line. You never know whether you're going to know how to do everything there. Or with that sense of mastery, you just presume you can handle anything. So up roots and head halfway across the country or 2,000 miles away to another country in a language that no other Anglo speaks and just plop yourself down and get busy. Stanley was a second kind. But he gave away his life. He gave away his dreams, let that flow through his fingers to grasp this in the seminary. And then later on, in his willingness, his pursuit of and given the gift of being ordained, his service as a priest, his decision to go to Guatemala, and then his decision to stay, his decision to conform his life to the needs there, his desire to put his roots down and to flower there. You know, when Stanley went back in April of 1981 and was murdered in July of 1981, if he had stayed behind in Oklahoma, the only thing he would have gained is more birthdays. He wouldn't have gained any more life. He gave his life away, and in the evidence of sanctity, when you give your life away, of course you receive it all back. What you give is given back to you. And so, when they came into the rectory and shot him early in the morning on the 28th, his life was attenuated. But if he had stayed behind in Oklahoma, he was convinced, I know he was, that it wouldn't have been the life that he was given. He was given another kind of life. So if he had collected more birthdays, it wouldn't have made his life more. He gave his life away in service before he gave it away in blood. The second thing is, the life of Christ is a model for our lives, not just a description of unfortunate events in Palestine. When we imitate Christ, we imitate what happens in the life of Christ. We give ourselves over to the Father's will. And whether that means that we live not or not quite 97 years, whatever however we conform to what's given, that we come in the Father's name, that we're given life in order that the Father's will, you know, pours out of our hands. Our lives are conformed to Christ's life. And so the more we give, the more we receive. On Calvary, on Good Friday, three people were crucified. Two had their lives taken away from them, and one gave his life away. You know, it isn't just a series of unfortunate events in Palestine that resulted in the resurrection. To imitate Christ is to imitate the gift of Christ's life so that the gift of life is given through us to the world. And number three is to the surrender to life, and what we're called to is the beginning of holiness, which is what Stanley did. And number four, I think to follow Christ isn't just about words or positions or formulas. It's about the decisions and actions and the meanings that they embody and communicate. Faithfulness without sacrifice is like trying to build a brick wall without mortar. One push, and it all falls down. And then finally, it's a quote from a letter that was read during the formation that Thérèse of Lisieux received when she went to the Carmelite monastery. It's from a Spanish nun, and it kind of circulated through the informal Carmelite formation process in the late 1800s. It, in fact, could be a quote that comes from the 1600s. And it's this, it's so great. This older Carmelite sister said to the young novices, "Most people will suffer more in their lives doing their will than you'll suffer in your life denying yours." Sacrifice is the beginning of holiness. Now, everybody here who's been a parent knows what I mean. Well, anybody here, I think, who stood up in front and said, "I do till death do us part," knows what that means. Yeah. Sacrifice is the beginning of holiness, not because you're going out going, I mean, here I am, or as Woody Allen would say, just practicing, you know. No. It's what life is. What is life is what we give away in it, what we sacrifice, what we offer. Hell is the place where everybody is in perfect possession of himself. His world is this big. Heaven is the place where everything has been given away. So, of course, with everything given, there's, of course, everything there. Or the difference between, what's the difference between receiving a gift and never unwrapping it, and receiving a gift, and not receiving it at all? There's no difference at all. You know, to unwrap the gift we've been given, you got to have open hands. The sacrifice is simply to open our hands. So what's in them flows out between our fingers, and they're ready to receive whatever is given to us. That's the life of Stanley Rother and what it means for us, I think. I'll close with this because how long do we stay? Till 8. Okay. Hey, we got 1 minute. Okay. On the 30th anniversary of Stan's death 4 years ago, we were down in Guatemala in Santiago. A really big, I mean, gigantic celebration. The Apostolic Nuncio was there. All the bishops of Guatemala were there. All the Americans who still work in Guatemala were there. And a big crowd from Oklahoma. They're all gathered inside the church, do what they always do. They take all the benches so that more people can crowd in. Probably 80% of the people there couldn't have known Stan. They were too young. There they were, part of this celebration. And just after the sermon, we could hear helicopters coming around outside. This was a sound, you know, from the 80s, was terrifying because it always meant the army helicopters. And, you know, I was just visiting. It always made my heart stop. Always bad news. Anyway, we heard that. And then about when communion started, this guy dressed in an American walks in a suit with his very nicely dressed entourage and sat down. So they kind of passed around the word. He's the American ambassador to Guatemala who shows up, was detained, so he showed up a little late. And so after the introductions and stuff, after communion, he stood up to speak. Of course, he's the American ambassador to Guatemala, which is truly arrogant. And then he did this. He began to speak to the people in Sotuhil, the native language of Santiago Atitlan, spoken in only three villages in the whole world. And he's, our ambassador is speaking to them in Sutuhil, and he asks them. Now, if Father Rother was your pastor, and his sacrifice was extraordinary, then he says, he asks them in Sutuhil, now you tell me, you let me know, is Father Rother dead? Or is he alive? Of course, everyone shouted back, alive. Now that's the power of sanctity, real holiness. It's not just his example that's alive. You know, it's not just his memory that's alive. All those things fade. Even the granite grave marker will eventually just become blank. All the memory will be gone. What remains, what lives, is this gift. Because it will be living 1,000 years from now in those who have no notion of what he or all of those of his generation or all of those who poured themselves out just as he did in faithfulness and service as well as in blood, the gift they gave. That will be living. And he will be living. That's what holiness is for and why the life of saints never goes out of style. Because the life of saints is what it means to be alive. It's what it means to have a life. So, any questions?
His sister used to live here in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. Is she still here?
She is in Wichita. Sister Marita. She headed off to the Precious Blood Convent the same year he headed off to the seminary. He was 18, she was 17. You know, isn't it kind of interesting? I mean, anybody who makes a permanent decision these days who's not yet like 35, we think, well, they don't know what they're doing, you know? He's 20 years older than I am. So I might not have been born when I wasn't born when he went to the seminary. You know, and the Okarchi that he grew up in was a lot different than the Okarchi today. I have an uncle who's just 10 years older than I am. So Stanley's 20 years older. He's 10 years older, my age. My uncle couldn't speak English when he started school, only German. So he grew up in a family where, you know, They spoke German, seriously. My mother couldn't speak English when she started school. So the Okarchi he grew up in looked a lot different than it looks today. Because, you know, I suppose every place looked different then than it does today. But now Stanley's life wasn't like that. And his father talked about that. His father talked to my grandfather's. He said it was the greatest thing because he grew up understanding German. He never spoke it much. So he said you'd pull into their driveway and all the kids would come running out of the house yelling at each other Germans. Which I'm not sure, I mean, that might sound too ominous for most folks. You know? A German telling a joke sounds like he's commanding the tanks into Moscow. So.
No, he was a chaplain at TU.
Stan. Yeah. He was ordained in 63 and went to Guatemala in 68. When Stan was murdered, they wanted his body shipped back to Okarchi, and which was, you know, the people there wanted to have him there, and but of course one of the things that went on in Santiago at the time was people kidnapped and people would never their and killed their bodies would never be returned. It's part of the programmed counterinsurgency force there. People just disappeared. It was very hard on the family. So they certainly understood as his family wanted his body back. But in order to ship the body internationally, they had to do an autopsy. And during the autopsy, they took out his heart. And so they agreed they would leave his heart behind. So they buried his heart in the church with a little shrine, but was immediately behind the high altar. Now, it was a nice little granite stone memorial, but it was in the back part of the church. You had to go back there with a flashlight to actually see where this thing was. So about 15 years after that, Father Tom McSherry, they wanted to do some remodeling in the church. And they also wanted to recognize all the other people in Santiago who had been murdered during this time, not just the pastor, but many, many, many people. And many of those, not just randomly, but targeted because they were leaders in the church. They created a shrine on the wall. So as you walk in, on the right-hand side is the little shrine for all of this. But they took Stanley's heart and placed it in this shrine. So Tom McSherry's telling me this. He's there, and he said, it's stored in just, you know, it's just like a little special. It's what they get to go put this thing. So it's a little box, a mayonnaise jar with blood in it, and then some pieces of gauze with blood on it. So they open up the jar, the box, and the mayonnaise jar. The lid is all rusted, but the blood's still liquid and red. And the heart, he said, if you go to Safeway, and if you can imagine seeing a cow's heart in the meat, he said that's what it looks like. It was red, you know. And he said, I don't know about what all this is supposed to mean, but, you know, a piece of meat that's left out and exposed for a week would be black. 15 years, be dust. Still red. Blood still liquid. Now, Tom, if you've ever met Tom, is not the sort of squishy, pious type. He's about as far away from that as you can get. Cynical and Irish, that probably is a redundant term, but I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means, but I can tell you that's what I saw 15 years after. I don't know. What does it mean? Probably the minimum of what it means is this is something extraordinary. An extraordinary example of something. And I think, you know, some of the relics, some of the incorruptible examples of sanctity has something that communicates to us something about the extraordinary nature of the people in death that signals part of the extraordinary nature of their lives. And I think really goes to talk about, you know, life and a signal bigger than we normally imagine. That was the case with in Santiago.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You said you did a cursillo. What did you do after then?
What did I do after my cursillo?
Yeah.
I got ordained.
I thought it was. But I mean, did you go and been a?
Yeah, I've been a cursillo chaplain at about 150 cursillos. Mostly with the Spanish speaking.
Oh, I see. Well, Cursillo is Spanish.
Yeah, that's right.
Father Bill.
Well, he's a lot older than I am, so I really can't tell you a lot about Father Biller. I met him. I wrote a poem about him one time, but I'm afraid I can't tell you much about it. He is buried in Old Carchi. I was at his funeral. Father McSherry at St. Pat's, Northwest 19th and Penn, Portland. Yeah.
I know that he's now blessed, Father Rother, but do you have any updates on
the cause? The last thing that the Archbishop said, this was at the end of the summer. He was at a thing in Rome for something, and there was a kind of seminar offered for all the bishops in the world who had cases pending. It was offered by the Committee for Saints in Rome. And so He attended. And so at the end of the morning, Cardinal comes up, who was doing the presentation. He says, "So what are you here for?" And he said, "Well, I just wanted to make sure." And he says, "Well, you've done everything." He said, "I mean, this is all done." The bishop was thinking, "Ooh, maybe, what we were was maybe while he's in the United States, maybe he'll just announce that, you know." Alas, that didn't happen. So, of course, when you're a cardinal in Rome, any time could mean before you die. That's all he knows. At least that's all he's told us. So we're kind of waiting. Well, we are waiting. It could come tomorrow, next year, whenever. I mean, the announcement as far as the beatification goes. Pardon me? Yeah. There are a couple of things. One is that one of the instructions is, you know, that they would exhume and inspect his body. They would take several relics and then bury his body at a place suitable for veneration, is what they say. So just going out to the cemetery wouldn't be enough. Now, there's some contention about what that ought to look like, what a shrine where his body is should look like. The bishop's suggestion is in the cathedral in Oklahoma City. Others of us who have roots in Okarchi have other ideas. I met with a group of people from Okarchi who said, you know, how can we get the shrine in Okarchi? And I said, it's no problem. Raise $10 million. You go to the archbishop and say, we're going to build a shrine to Father Rother. We want his body there. You know, no problem. $10 million. No, it's in Santiago. His body is buried at the cemetery in Okarchi. If you ever go into the cemetery, you go to the altar and the crucifix is, and you go off to the left, just to the left of where the altar is. The archbishop said we ought to write a prayer, and we should pick a scripture. And so a couple of the guys got together and wrote a prayer, and we presented it to the priest council. We made, you know, some of us with who have more poetic bones in our body made a few suggestions, and we had a prayer. So. Pray for the process of his beatification and canonization. I think it's important for the church in Oklahoma. I think it's important for believers in a contemporary world that doesn't think much about the meaning of life. And I think it's important for everyone who can look into the mirror and imagine what the glory of the Lord reflected in our faces should look like. I think it's important for all of us to know that sanctity is not something from the first century of the church. It's not something for all those people who have to undergo awful things in a place far away. Sanctity is something that lives among us. It's reflected in the life of somebody like us. It's an experience available to us. And so at the beatification and canonization, all of us can celebrate that this is as real to us as finding that place on the map that says Okarchi. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Father Wolf, for the wonderful discussion and the presentation about Father Stan Rother. And thank you all for being here this evening. The next time that we'll gather for our Theology in Court will be in January. We're taking December off. We'll gather on January the 14th. Father Jack Gleason, the former pastor here at the Madeleine, will be our presenter. He'll be talking about the Jewish roots of the Eucharist. Again, all are welcome. Guests are welcome. Also, Vanessa, let you know that for our parish, we're in the midst of having a pictorial directory done. We still have some signups for this week and the remainder of the week just right before Thanksgiving. That's there by the, Anne is holding up, the signup. Also for the men of our parish, we gather on Wednesday mornings at 6, here in the parish hall for breakfast. Then we have a scripture study for the Gospels for the upcoming Sunday. All the men in the parish are welcome to take part. If you want to receive the information about